Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast for today. Our subject is immunity. It's appropriate because it's cold outside and holidays are upon us. And sometimes after the holidays, after all that stress, and sometimes not so great eating, a little sleep deprivation. And that's when it seems that lots of people get sick. So we're talking about how to formulate a little bit of a protective bulwark against infection using lifestyle approaches, but also with specific nutrients. So, Tom, let's do a little bit of a lightning round during this part two and kind of go through a comprehensive list of some of the plausible nutrients that are involved in immune support. So where do you want to start?
Well, I think the one that everybody talks about is echinacea, and be a good place to start. I think echinacea is actually three different plant species, Echinacea purpurea, which is the one that we think of, purple coneflower, and then there's the two others, Echinacea angustifolia and Echinacea pallida. These have been used mostly in Western herbal medicine for several hundred years. We know a lot about these, in most cases, either the whole plant or some cases the root of certain plants are used, and I think probably one of the most popular herbs used for immune benefit, let's say, in the United States. I really think that there's really compelling data on echinacea. Some of the data kind of goes back and forth, and part of it has to do with how studies are done. So when they take an herb like echinacea or some sort of herbal blend with several different, let's say, herbs, but let's say with echinacea in, what you have to do is you either have to give somebody a cold virus, like you come into the office and you stick a cold virus up their nose, or you have to wait for someone to get a cold and then immediately call you so they can start on the echinacea.
Right.
It's very difficult because the problem is if you just give it to, let's say, 100 people, well, some of those people may come into contact with a cold virus and other people won't. And so it's very difficult to do a study on the ability of anything, for instance, but especially like an herb, to be able to block or shorten a cold or reduce the symptoms of a cold. But when you look at this, I think overall the data on echinacea does suggest that not only does it reduce the severity, but also the length of a cold, usually a virus. And I think if you look at the mechanisms involved, where you start looking at in animal studies or other ways of modulating immune function, you start seeing, I think a robust set of data to suggest, yes, it does. It is modulating the immune system. And interestingly, it also has some of these polysaccharides, among other things, that probably function to stimulate the immune system. So, as with other things, and I'll mention this later, but as with other things, I do like the idea of stimulating the immune system or modulating the immune system, whatever you want to say, using some of these herbs that we'll mention. But usually I'd like to upregulate the immune system right around the time when you think you might get sick, quote-unquote flu, cold and flu season. Perhaps we don't want to do this all year long. Mm-hmm. And there's some debate about whether or not because of autoimmune, but whether the immune system will eventually just get so used to seeing these things that it'll just ignore them after a while. And maybe that's a bad thing if we want to try to upregulate the immune system over a short period of time. So I'm a big fan of echinacea and echinacea extracts, and really mostly the use of echinacea purpurea and angustifolia are probably the two ones that are probably the most the data that's out there. Another one that I think that is gaining in popularity and I think gaining in research is the use of elderberry.
Mm-hmm.
Some people call this Sambucus nigra because it's black elderberry. That's the Latin name for it. And it's not only the leaves and the flowers and the berries, all three in various combinations and various extracts. And we're starting to see more and more data on the use of elderberry and elderberry extracts as being beneficial specifically in cold and flu type situations. And oftentimes in combination with echinacea, you see these two used quite a bit in Europe in combination with one another in clinical trials, especially for sort of these generic immune boosting cold and flu season type products. course, there's a number of other things that we can look at. One that I like is something called andrographis.
Mm-hmm.
It's used quite a bit in traditional Eastern medicine. And some of these are used specifically for other sorts of things, like not just colds and flus, but maybe upper respiratory tract infections. In this case of andrographis, it's often used in combination with what we used to call a Siberian ginseng. Now we call it Eleutherol.
Mm-hmm.
But in combination, andrographis has been used to help with upper respiratory tract infections, things like sinusitis. And in combination with echinacea and others, you'll find not only are they immune modulating herbs, but some of these actually have anti-inflammatory effects as well as direct antimicrobial effects. So if I could just back up for a minute, we can help the immune system by directly helping the immune system function, but you can also help the immune system by getting rid of the bacteria or virus for it. So if you can be antiviral or antibacterial, then you can also help the immune system so that the immune system doesn't have so many enemies. And so we see these things also with andrographis, maybe even with echinacea and elderberry, that have some direct effect on the organisms.
What about? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to ask about pelargonium. Which is a geranium-derived herbal.
Yeah, so pelargonium, and I mean, if you go down the list, there's quite a few herbs that have been used in very specific areas, like astragalus and others. Some mm-hmm. are what I would say very traditional Chinese medicine herbs. Some are, the one you mentioned, pelargonium, is I think it's not as widely used in the United States, certainly.
European.
But some of these find their ways in very small pockets, like you just mentioned, in the European medicine tradition, or traditional Chinese medicine, or Ayurvedic medicine. Those are kind of the three big herbal areas that have come down to us. And you had mentioned earlier the idea of mushrooms, and we talked about mushrooms and beta glucans from yeast, or these various beta or alpha glucans from mushrooms, but things like arabinogalactan,
from large trees.
Yeah, exactly. And all of these types of things, arabinogalactan maybe more specifically, has been shown to upregulate the effects of a natural killer cell activity. But many of these are thought to be because arabinogalactan can be fermented by the good bacteria in our gut, and that could also be true of things like inulin. Or chicory root, or these kind of things. We usually call these prebiotics, but they can upregulate the immune system, maybe indirectly by affecting the good bacteria in our gut, and then all kinds of things happen at that point. Once you upregulate the immune system through the gut microbiome, then you have this big, very broad effect that can be measured in a number of different ways.
What's your take on transfer factor or colostrum-derived products?
So this is an area, so we think of colostrum, that first couple days of milk produced after the baby, and of course, in humans, colostrum is high in immunoglobulin A, secretory IgA, very high in IgA, and it has other growth factors, including transfer factor, lactoferrin, which is an iron-binding protein, and the use of colostrum from cows, so this has become quite popular now to use colostrum extracts or concentrates, and in cows, actually, they produce IgG mostly, not IgA. So, but along with these, so you can get very concentrated immunoglobulin colostrum products, maybe like 40% IgG-type products, and along with that comes some of the growth factors and lactoferrin, and so these are going to be immune stimulating. They're also going to be, the IgG itself could bind then to some of the bacteria in the gut and create sort of a balancing effect, and oftentimes the IgG in those are thought to reduce the antigenic load that somebody may have. So if they're, let's say in their diet they're consuming and they've got a lot of bad bacteria or other things that may be problematic, you could reduce the viral load, reduce the bacterial load so that the immune system can tolerate it. The overall use of bovine colostrum has been generally positive, although you see some studies showing some real benefits, other studies that don't seem to show other benefits. I think it really depends on factors that we don't exactly know what creates a susceptibility in an individual that colostrum can benefit, if that makes sense. If we had the right group of people that we understood that had a specific need for that, I think we'd find a much better effect. And oftentimes these colostrum studies are done just in a very general population, and so I think we get very general sort of results. But when you have specific individuals that have harmful organs like Cryptosporidium or Shigella, you know, Clostridium or something like this, then we definitely see some benefit when using these colostrum type products.
To support the immune system's natural resistance to these types of things.
Right, right. And in some cases we see, you know, obviously we'd like to be able to stimulate the body's own secretory IgA. We produce our own antibodies, mostly as IgA, into the gut. And, of course, that helps the immune system. The immune system is able to sort of tag some of these bad guys in the gut before they have a chance to come in or before they have any of their metabolites can come in. And so sometimes it appears that some of the growth factors that come along with colostrum are able to stimulate the immune system. It's not necessarily the IgG themselves that come from the colostrum.
Mm-hmm. What about the category of things that are billed as natural antimicrobials or natural antibiotics? Olive leaf, oregano, things of that ilk.
Right.
Has that been investigated thoroughly?
Yeah, so, well, investigated thoroughly, maybe I would say no, but certainly investigated in very specific situations. So there's a number of different organisms that are susceptible to specific herbs, and we've discovered these over the years. And so, like, things like candida, and we know that candida, the yeast that can grow and is part of our life, can overgrow in many people, and it seems to be very susceptible. I think you mentioned olive leaf extract, things like oregano extract, thyme, thymol, which is in thyme, can be very powerful at destroying or disabling candida. And actually clove oil, eugenol, which is the essential oil that comes from clove. So we've learned not only are they effective at defeating candida, but those three oils can be very powerful against some parasites even. So
staph,
we've
possibly,
that
I think, staph, in the case of oregano, I think
exactly,
there's some good studies on.
Well, yeah, if you look across on oregano extracts and things like this, I'm just mentioning candida, but there are very specific organisms that are vulnerable to that. If you start looking at around at other sorts of antiviral or antibacterial, you know, one that we've talked about, I think, in other contexts before are berberine. Mm-hmm. Are berberine alkaloids, and these have been used in a number of different traditions, from very like golden seal root or golden thread or Oregon grape root or some of the names of the botanicals, but usually they come in these yellowish orange alkaloids, very bitter, but also have been shown to be not only good at destroying bacteria or modulating the gut bacteria in a positive way in the gut, but also having what appears to be antibacterial effects, maybe even antiviral effects throughout the body systemically. And that's why berberine is also used for things like sinusitis or upper respiratory tract infections. Something like Uva ursi, I mean, maybe people haven't heard of this, it's called bearberry.
Right.
But Uva ursi is another name that's often given.
For urinary tract infections.
Exactly. And so what happens here is, This is a leaf and a leaf or a leaf extract, and here we see that when it's consumed and it goes into the bladder, because of the pH of the bladder, it allows for the formation of something called hydroquinone, which is a a compound that's made from the arbutin, which is found in Uversi, and this just happens to be a very good antiseptic or a very good sterilizer of the bladder. Mm-hmm. So in we see the use of Uversi maybe in combination with other things that help increase urine flow, but we see some of these being used in products that are used for urinary tract infections.
Is there not a prohibition on using Uversi for too long a period because of some of the adverse effects?
So, you know, if we're going to, you know, people use like cranberry, let's say, or something like that to prevent the recurrence of a UTI. Of a urinary tract infection, and we know sort of how cranberry works and by blocking some of the, either by directly affecting, usually E. coli is the organism that causes most urinary tract infections, or by blocking its ability to bind to the bladder or to the urinary tract. So things like Uversi should only be used when you, really not as a preventive agent, but really should be used only when you suspect that you or your, you know, somebody has a UTI and wants to use it for very short, you know, within weeks. If you really haven't accomplished what you're trying to do within weeks with an Uversi type product, then you obviously may want to consider some other way of handling that. And it shouldn't be used as a long-term prophylactic like you could maybe with cranberry juice. Mm-hmm. Or cranberry juice extracts. And it should be noted that most people, you know, maybe aren't familiar with this, cranberry juice cocktail is not the same thing.
Exactly.
Cranberry juice cocktail is almost all something else other than cranberry juice, and usually has way more sugar than you should be consuming to prevent a UTI. So you really want to either use, you know, concentrated, you know, cranberry juice, not a cocktail, or a cranberry juice extract powder, which is, you know, one of these ones that has high amounts of active ingredients.
Mm-hmm. Let's conclude our discussion by talking about some of the alphabet nutrients and some of the minerals, the more classic supplements. So let's go through the list, you know, starting with vitamin A. Any evidence for vitamin A supplementation for people subject to immune problems?
Yeah, so the use of all the vitamins, I think we'll find that there's varying degrees of direct evidence on both prophylaxis on the one hand, or treatment on the other. Vitamin A, and I think we should distinguish between beta carotene, which is the pre-vitamin A, and high doses of, let's say, vitamin A, which is the retinol form, and so. Some people are a little concerned with taking high doses mm-hmm. of retinol or the preformed vitamin A, but I will say that the data on its ability to affect an acute infection or immune function is much better than beta-carotene. Mm-hmm. So we typically tell people that on a short-term basis, taking higher doses of vitamin A as preformed, and you usually see this as retinol palmitate or something like that, even upwards of, you know, 20 or 30,000 international units mm-hmm. is safe and effective, but usually for weeks, not months. Mm-hmm. And on a daily basis, usually staying below 10,000 international units is healthy and, right. and safe. There's some debate now. Used to be people were afraid to take more than like 7,500 IUs, but I think the 10,000 is fine. Mm-hmm. Beta-carotene, I think, getting natural beta-carotene, I think, is important and because it has other benefits in the body, but it's not as, let's say, robust at being an immune modulator as retinol palmitate or one of the retinols directly.
How about vitamin C? Is there really evidence that, and I'm sure you've looked at the data, that vitamin C intake can shorten the duration of colds or prevent colds? What does this research say?
Right, so I think clearly it's probably one of the most researched ones of all. I would recommend that people who really want to get into the details of that go to the Linus Pauling Institute. I think they've probably done the best collection of data on vitamin C ascorbic acid studies on the benefit of the use of ascorbic acid in reducing colds and flus and having other modulatory effects. But I think I think it's clear that increasing vitamin C intake is, if nothing else, it's going to be neutral, but it has a very good likelihood of benefiting, taking it on a short-term basis. Maybe, as you probably recommend, several grams a day, perhaps, during 2, maybe 3, even more, 1,000 milligrams per day. And you may even have, I don't have experience with it intravenously, but I know that many clinicians actually use it intravenously. That's not my expertise, but clearly that's been shown to be beneficial as well.
Yeah, and I kind of hearken back to the research of Dr. Klenner, in the 1940s and 50s, where before the advent of vaccines for polio and, antiviral medications, he was taking on many patients with serious viral infections with high-dose vitamin C. I still think it's a potent tool. So let's also talk about vitamin D and the duality of vitamin D for immunity, because, on the one hand, it seems to help people fend off infections, but it seems to also be helpful for autoimmunity.
So vitamin D, we think of vitamins, obviously, as being, sort of these helpers of enzymes, but vitamin D is very different. Vitamin D is really like a hormone, and it modulates the change in genetic expression of lots of different genes. And as it turns out, the immune system and the immune cells have lots of genes that are regulated by the vitamin D and its receptor. So and of course, maybe not coincidentally, when the sun goes down, I think today is the shortest day of the year as we're speaking. Mm-hmm. So when the sunlight is the shortest, vitamin D levels go down even further, although unfortunately they're even low in the summer in many cases. But people's vitamin D level goes down, not surprisingly, the immune system weakness is at a similar time. So clearly I believe there is a link between a low level of vitamin D and immune susceptibility. It's very easy to get vitamin D levels with supplementation. We see lots of benefits, a lot of change when you give vitamin D. We've looked at genetic expression in immune tissue, and we see a robust change in immune function when we give not only animals, but we see this in humans, vitamin D levels. And also we see a reduced level of autoimmunity, like you mentioned, and there's numbers of different pathways by which reduced vitamin D can increase the susceptibility of autoimmunity. And this tells us it's not just a, turn on, turn off. It really is a modulation. That's why we get improved immunity and a decrease in autoimmunity at the same time.
And finally, let's talk about zinc and selenium. We talked a little bit about vitamin E in part one. Vitamin E certainly, if it's deficient, can result, especially in older people. Studies have documented that low vitamin E can render them more susceptible to infections and even render them less able to respond to vaccines. But zinc and selenium also are on the menu for immune support.
Right. So, this is kind of one of those areas where, once an area is explored, it's like getting gold. Somebody finds a chunk of gold in a hill, everyone shows up. So as it turns out, that's the way it was with zinc. Zinc was discovered early as being very important in the immune system. And so probably, maybe disproportionately, we have lots of studies on zinc, and we may find other types of minerals have others, magnesium, other things. And we do know that they're very beneficial, but it seems like zinc is an area where a lot of research has been done, showing, because zinc is used for hundreds of different enzymatic reactions. As it turns out, zinc depletion has been shown to correspond with immune suppression or low immune function, and we see in many cases where zinc levels are increased that you then increase immune function. The question is, how much zinc can you take, or should you take? And for how much time? And right now I'm actually doing some studies looking at the big study, AREDS, for eye health, and they ended up using 80 milligrams of zinc, and they used the zinc oxide, which is actually a very poor form of zinc. Mm-hmm. And I think 80 milligrams of zinc, especially if it's a good form of zinc, is probably more than most people would need on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, there's sort of this range. And so if you're using bad forms of zinc, I guess you need more of it. But if you're using a good form of zinc, or like a chelated form, You know, probably somewhere less than 50 milligrams, and perhaps 15 to 50 would be in a range that I think a lot of people should consider being helpful, especially during where they want to boost the immune system.
You're not a big believer in zinc lozenges for colds, you know, like slam the zinc for a few days? Is that
how you... So zinc lozenges, there was a lot of idea that if you took the lozenge and you actually coated, you were able to coat the upper respiratory tract perhaps a little bit with zinc, that you would block the binding. And there's a little bit of data out there that suggests that might be true, although most of that is probably going into the digestive tract and really being absorbed and used that way. So, I'm not as convinced that the zinc lozenges are necessarily the way to go, but I don't know that I have a strong conviction against the use of zinc lozenges. Perhaps in some individuals that may be a comfortable way to take that along with something else.
Mm-hmm. Selenium?
So, right, so zinc, selenium, in the case of zinc, selenium are also cofactors for enzymes that are antioxidants. So we see selenium being used in combination with vitamin E in some cases, and show that we can improve both the immune cell function, and there's a number of animal studies and human studies. Here we're talking, instead of milligram doses, we're typically talking about microgram doses. So somewhere even as low as 200 micrograms can be helpful in some studies to improve immune cell function. But usually the range that people are talking about of selenium is 200 to 400 micrograms. So probably less data on immune outcomes using selenium than we see with like zinc or vitamin E, like you mentioned, or certainly vitamin C. But I think because of its overall benefit on improving antioxidant function, we should really have selenium should be really part of that multi-nutrient immune-boosting type situation.
Well, you've given us a very comprehensive crash course on immunity. Where can listeners go to find more? You've got a book entitled Supporting Immune Function, A Lifestyle and Nutrient Approach.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've obviously spent a lot of time on this. A lot of people don't know that my PhD actually is in molecular immunology, so even though I didn't try to get in too much of the molecular side of this, is an area that I feel, I have a good grasp of, and of course, this is an area that a lot of people have been asking about. So the book that you mentioned, Supporting Immune Function, is available on the website, thepointinstitute.org, and while it is designed, I guess, primarily for healthcare professionals, the data, and of course there's hundreds and hundreds of references in here that people can follow to get more information on their own. And I really spend a lot of time talking about mechanisms so people can understand the broader function to the immune system, because not only is it going to affect cold and flus, it's going to affect really everything, because the immune system is sort of the way that the body functions when it comes to chronic disease as well. So it's really an important phenomenon to understand and get a good grasp of how it works.
Well, that's excellent. I really appreciate your time. I urge our listeners, our clinicians, and our nutrition aficionados to go get the book, Supporting Immune Function. PointInstitute.org is the place to go. Thanks very much for joining us, Dr. Thomas Williams. It's always a pleasure, and I wish you and your family a very happy holiday.
Okay, you too, and I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.